Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Supreme Court nominee Judge Neil Gorsuch came under the Senate microscope, showing charm, independence, and discipline.
I'd like to have you describe in any way you want to what judicial independence means.
I have no difficulty ruling against or for any party other than based on what the law and the facts in the particular case require. And I'm heartened by the support I have received.
Some senators worked hard to ruffle the judge, but came off looking weak.
How do we have confidence in you that you won't just be for the big corporations, that you will be for the little men? I'm just looking for something that would indicate that you would give a worker a fair shot.
The other huge story, will the American Health Care Act pass Congress? It's not going to be easy. House Speaker Paul Ryan is, however, supremely confident.
We have a very engaged president. I am so pleased and impressed with Donald Trump and Mike Pence.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Good to be with you. Congress this week took a substantial step towards filling the Supreme Court seat left vacant by the sudden death last February of the great Antonin Scalia. The nominee, Judge Neil Gorsuch, was subjected to marathon hearings before the Judiciary Committee of the U.S. Senate. His performance spoke volumes about President Trump's ability to deliver on his promises. The 49-year-old Gorsuch presented himself very well.
Mr. Chairman, as a student many years ago, I found myself walking through the old Granary burial ground in Boston. It's where Paul Revere, John Hancock, and many of our founders are buried. And there I came across the tombstone of a lawyer and judge who today is largely forgotten, as we're all destined to be soon enough. His name was Increase Sumner, and written onto his tombstone over 200 years ago was this description of the man. As a lawyer, he was faithful and able. As a judge, patient, impartial, and decisive. In private life, he was affectionate and mild. In public life, he was dignified and firm. Party feuds were allayed by the correctness of his conduct. Calumny was silenced by the weight of his virtues, and rancor softened by the amenity of his manners. Mr. Chairman, those words stick with me. I keep them on my desk. They serve for me as a daily reminder of the law's integrity, that a useful life can be led in its service, of the hard work it takes, and an encouragement to good habits when I fail and when I falter. At the end of it all, I could ask for nothing more than to be described as he was. And if confirmed, I pledge to you that I will do everything in my power to be that man.
Nebraska Senator and Republican Ben Sasse spoke eloquently about the right role of the judge in his opening statement.
I want to make three simple overlapping points about that judge's black robe. One, it changes the way that our eyes see the court. Two, it reiterates the calling of a judge to the judge. And three, it gives us a special opportunity to teach our kids something about their Constitution, the enduring paper that defines what our government can and cannot do.
But Mazie Hirono, the Democratic senator from Hawaii, seemed to be missing the point about the role of a judge.
So, Judge Gorsuch, we need to know what's in your heart. We need to understand how you will grapple with a number of important questions the court will be asked to consider in the years ahead.
On Tuesday, the questioning by the panel, instead of diminishing him, was a showcase of Judge Gorsuch's near-perfect qualifications. My Salem colleague, Michael Medved, was impressed.
First of all, I need to say something about the hearings. I've been watching them. I find them spellbinding. It's spellbinding because it's in a way, so funny. I mean, really, it is. For the most part, the hearings I'm talking about are the great hearings with Neil Gorsuch, who is just tremendous. I didn't know. I mean, I knew him as a judge. I knew he was a very respected judge, a brilliant legal mind, an unbelievable academic background, respected by everybody, his Democratic clerks, his Democratic colleagues. I mean, it's impossible to find anybody with a negative word against Judge Gorsuch, except the Democrats will find some means of voting against him anyway. A lot of the hearing, it's as if you watched somebody doing batting practice where they allowed some little league pitcher to be throwing up batting practice to a major league all-star. And the major league all-star doesn't have to break a sweat. He just takes these cookies, these balls that come up one after another, and just proceeds to knock them out of the park. What is very striking is when the Democratic senators are trying to cut Neil Gorsuch down to size, Dianne Feinstein, who really should be retired in 2018, she's 85 years old. You talk about somebody, I 85 years young. I get it. Baby boomers. I guess she doesn't even qualify as a baby boomer at her age. But in any event, the point being that Senator Feinstein, who is the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, was determined to embarrass Neil Gorsuch using her supremely erudite legal education to try to cut him down to size.
How do we have confidence in you that you won't just be for the big corporations, that you will be for the little men? This is the question that Senator Hirono, I think, so well asked yesterday. You know, those of us, I think, on both sides care very much about workers' rights. But the record is such that one questions whether the court is capable in its present composition to give a worker a fair shot. So I'm just looking for something that would indicate that you would give a worker a fair shot. Maybe it's in your background somewhere that I don't know about, but I'd like to have you respond to it any way you can.
There's nothing in his background that indicates you would give a worker a fair shot. What is his background? A ruthless corporate exploiter? She goes on with an... first of all, the response from Judge Gorsuch, here he is.
Senator, I really appreciate that. I think there is a way you can take a look at this question without me potentially prejudging a case. And I appreciate your respect for that. And just to finish that thought, I'm concerned that I have to look the litigant in the eye in the next case. And if I've prejudged that case, they can look at me and say, you're not a fair judge. And I've got no answer for that. Got no answer for that. So what I think can give you comfort in this area is, Senator, I know a case or two has been mentioned yesterday. Respectfully, I'd suggest that does not represent the body of my work. I've written 2,700, I participated in 2,700 opinions over 10 and a half years. And if you want cases where I've ruled for the little guy as well as the big guy, there are plenty of them, Senator.
Okay, and not only that, one of the points he made in his opening statement is that of those 2,700 cases, and this has been fact-checked, and this is the facts. I mean, what he's talking about, that 97% of the cases, here is what he explained yesterday, and let him say it in his own words. This is Judge Gorsuch in his opening statement yesterday.
Over the last decade, I've participated in over 2,700 appeals. Often these cases are hard, too. Only about 5% of all federal lawsuits make their way to decision in a court of appeals. I've served with judges appointed by President Obama all the way back to President Johnson. And in the Tenth Circuit, we hear cases from six different states covering two time zones and 20% of the continental United States. But in the West, we listen to one another, respectfully. We tolerate, we cherish different points of view. And we seek consensus whenever we can. My law clerks tell me that 97% of those 2,700 cases I've decided were decided unanimously. And that I've been in the majority 99% of the time.
Okay. That's kind of remarkable when you think about it. I mean, again, 99% of the time he's in the majority. Now, is she saying that all of the judges, including the judges that were appointed by President Carter, and there are some on that Circuit Court of Appeals, judges who are appointed by President Clinton, judges who are appointed by President Obama, they all can't favor the little guy? Look, this whole idea about favoring the little guy. This goes to the dichotomy that I was posing to you yesterday, and it's something from my wife's book, and which I take very seriously. The book is called Don't Divorce. And she writes in there that the crucial element for basically success in career and very much success in marriage, success in personal relationships and anything, is prioritizing do your duty, do the right thing, over follow your heart. You may feel all the compassion you want for the little guy, but there's a reason that the Bible, which is kind of a source of morality for everybody, in the book of Leviticus, chapter 19, verse 15, it's one of the most important verses in the whole Bible. And it is the foundation for a fair legal system. It says, do not pervert justice. Do not show favor to the poor or honor the face of the great. Judge your neighbor fairly. Now, what does that mean? Why does it say first? It doesn't say don't favor the rich guy. It says don't show favor to the poor. Because there's an understanding that would be a temptation. One of the things that the Bible wants us to do is, yes, be kind and generous to the orphan and the widow and the destitute. But you do that through your personal contributions. When it comes to the law, you have to be impartial. So what is it that the left wants to do? They want to smear Judge Gorsuch. Well, here, the Wall Street Journal actually has a good report, and a report by Jess Braven. And this is most serious. They tried to tie Judge Gorsuch to the evil Trump. So very appropriately, Lindsey Graham, who has been leading the fight for the confirmation of Judge Gorsuch, Lindsey Graham asked a very pertinent question.
Did you ever met President Trump personally?
Not until my interview.
In that interview, did he ever ask you to overrule Roe v. Wade?
No, Senator.
What would he have done if he'd asked?
Senator, I would have walked out the door. It's not what judges do.
Okay.
They don't do it at that end of Pennsylvania Avenue, and they shouldn't do it at this end either, respectfully.
Okay, is that a clear enough statement? By the way, it's a great statement, because it makes Judge Gorsuch look good, and it makes President Trump look good. No, he didn't ask a stupid and inappropriate question.
When we return, the effort to repeal and replace Obamacare.
We promised the American people we would repeal and replace this law.
High hopes and resolve from Speaker Ryan when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. During the run-up to the November presidential election, two issues were of highest importance to conservatives. Unquestionably, the first was judicial appointments, which seemed to be moving along nicely, if Judge Gorsuch is any measure. The second priority among many of us had to be repeal and replace of Obamacare. That is, before it collapses under its own weight and pulls America's vaunted health care industry down with it. It's a bellwether issue for Republicans, an issue I've tracked with closely. I caught up with Speaker Paul Ryan on Wednesday. I had the other Ryan on earlier today. Tim Ryan is my pal from Warren,
yeah,
Ohio.
Yeah, I get his mail sometimes.
And he's a good guy, but he doesn't admit the basic thing I want to begin with. Obamacare has collapsed. He pointed out to me 55 people in Trumbull County died of opioid in the first month of this year. And the healthcare system is not working. Do Democrats not get this?
Yeah, I think they just have this ideological quest for basically a government-run healthcare, single-payer healthcare. They see Obamacare as a means to that end. They wanted to get it all in the full swoop, and they've always believed that the system will probably collapse the insurance companies. They would be in power when that happens, and then they'd have what we call the public option, where they just put in place a government program to give cradle-to-grave health care, and voila, you got government-run health care. And I think they want to hold on to that dream, and I think that that's kind of why they're in denial that this stage of their march toward government-run health care is collapsing. The insurers are leaving the market. The premiums are skyrocketing, and no one's using it. I mean, it's a lot of folks just can't afford it, or you have the pullouts where they don't even get a choice anymore.
And on the other side, we have, like, my friend Lindsey Graham, your friend, came on the show last week and said maybe collapse and repeal is better. I think that's inhumane. We can't let Americans...
from a moral standpoint.
Yeah.
I think what most people will say is, you Republicans are in power. You got to do something about this. I think if people, if we just did nothing, and then what the insurers are telling us is doing nothing, you're going to have about a 40 or so percent increase on average this coming year in 2018. People will get those notices this fall and say November. They'll have fewer choices. They'll have more pullouts, maybe no insurers in certain areas. That's already the case in Tennessee. And then massive premium increases, and they'll say, you guys are in power. Why did you let this happen? So I just don't think that that's the right course for lots of reasons. Our whole thing is we don't want to load up our bill in such a way that it doesn't even get considered in the Senate, and it's killed in the Senate, and then we lost our one chance with this one tool we have, reconciliation. It doesn't last long. But if the Senate can add things to the bill, then we're all for that. Here's the way it works. I know this is kind of inside baseball. If we add provisions to the bill that make it, they call it fatal, which takes it out of the reconciliation realm, then the bill won't even be considered, won't even be brought up. But the Senate can test that rule with individual amendments, with individual policies.
I did not know that.
Test that.
I did not know that. So you,
that is not fatal. The provision is struck, but not the whole bill is struck. So if we load the bill up with things we like, the bill itself is dead. They in the Senate can add the things we like, and if it rules out of order, just that provision goes away. It doesn't kill the whole bill.
Okay, I'm not ashamed to say I did not know that. That's a hell of an argument for pushing forward to see what can be done.
That's right. We want to beta test these ideas in the Senate. We want that. We want our senators running amendments on the things we like to see if they can get past what we call the Byrd rule, this reconciliation rule. And the reason I feel good where we are is, number one, this is good policy. We are repealing Obamacare and replacing it with good Republican tax policy. And number two, Tom Price is working really hard and getting us the kind of regulatory relief. He's doing what Kathleen Sebelius and Sylvia Burwell did in reverse, which will dramatically deregulate the health insurance marketplace, let the states go back to being in charge of regulating their marketplaces, and that will dramatically lower premiums far below what even the CBO says. And the CBO says the reforms in this bill alone will lower premiums when those reforms kick in. We have good reforms. Number two, we've got a promise to keep. We promised the American people we would repeal and replace this law. We have to do it for real, not for fake, for real. And that means the only way to do this is through reconciliation. We don't have 60 senators. We have 52. Remember, the Democrats put this in law with 60 votes. We're going to get rid of it with 50 votes, and that makes it harder to do. But a real promise kept is one where we actually use the only process we have to actually repeal this law. And so I believe at the end of the day, members are going to say, I'm going to keep my promise to the people who voted for me, who sent me into office. And number three, we have a very engaged president. I am so pleased and impressed with Donald Trump and Mike Pence, who are really leaning into this thing, working hard, talking to members, brokering things, getting it done, leaning into it. So we have an engaged president. We have a prominent promise to keep, and we have good policy.
Meanwhile, news of wiretapping, surveillance, and deliberate leaks from our national security organizations has been dominating news for weeks. My colleague Mike Gallagher sought to bring clarity to the matter when he spoke with author and investigative reporter Cheryl Atkinson, host of Full Measure.
Let's cut to the chase. Is it completely insane to think that there could have been government surveillance of Trump associates who could have been in or around Trump Tower?
Well, no, and to be clear, I don't have inside information on this. I simply know from what we know factually about the Obama administration's unprecedented surveillance of journalists, of whistleblowers, that it certainly isn't outside the realm of possibility because they were pushing the envelope, according to intel officials, on many fronts when it comes to surveillance of private citizens or officials. They were even surveilling members of Congress. They were surveilling or monitoring the phone records of congressional intelligence committees over in the intelligence committee in the Senate. So the idea that this is absurd, I think, is off base.
If I may, you have a little bit of personal experience in this field.
Well, yes, I guess my case of the government software being in my computer, surveilling my keystrokes and classified documents being planted in my CBS computer and so on, proven by four forensics exams. That was the first one, I guess, we knew of. But following that was, of course, that the government had monitored Associated Press, Fox News, the Edward Snowden revelation, Clapper's false testimony, the former head of DNI to Congress claiming there was no widespread surveillance. So it's a complicated question that if anybody thinks it's an easy, simple thing, to answer? I don't think it is, based on what we know.
But what I do know is easy is on January 19th, the New York Times reported that officials confirmed there was surveillance of Trump associates in as they investigated possible Russia-Trump campaign collusion. At that time, during the campaign, the Trump campaign was run out of Trump Tower. All his whole base of operations was at Trump Tower here in New York City. And yet that New York Times report, the media today seems to shrug that off. They say, was that report, do you think, incorrect? Because I guess the question is, if there was surveillance of Trump associates and campaign officials and anybody else associated with Mr. Trump during the campaign, how is it completely impossible that that none of them ever went into Trump Tower?
Well, that's the logic I'm using, although I do think the media in its effort to try to prove Trump wrong is operating with precision that's unnecessary and doesn't really get at the truth. Mm-hmm. They're parsing the definition of wiretap, which is fair enough to do so in deciding whether Trump should have made that particular allegation.
Right.
But the bigger question is, was there surveillance? And there are many ways, I know from my case and from sources, to capture people in surveillance whose names are not on wiretap, Title III wiretaps, or whose names are not on FISA court orders. There are many ways this can and has been done. In shorthand, one of the big reasons I think we're seeing this, there's not only a Republican and Democrat establishment, there's a media establishment that may be as equally powerful or entrenched as the political establishment. And they, too, have been challenged by this presidency and election of Donald Trump. And I think this backlash by all three of those groups I just named is creating the atmosphere that you're describing.
Coming up,
this is a story that I think has continued to be in the ether for the last several weeks, and obviously it's something that's of concern to the White House.
When the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. We all have to agree on one thing. The White House has been the crucible ever since President Trump's inauguration. Not only has there been continuous conflict with the White House and the media, but fights in and around it seem to be breaking out everywhere. Yes, some of this conflict is self-imposed, but the administration never had anything resembling a honeymoon. Lonnie Chen of the Hoover Institution is a friend I rely on when it comes to political and policy matters in Washington. He joined me for a wide-ranging discussion on matters of deep concern to our president. I will come back to Obamacare after we talk about Neil Gorsuch. I do not anticipate any trouble in his confirmation, Lonnie. What about you?
I don't either. I mean, if you look at this guy's record, if you look at everything that he's done so far, he's really done the spade work that you need to do as a nominee, someone in his position. He's met with all the senators. He's expressed his points of view in private meetings, and I think he's done a great job. I think they've done a great job shepherding him through so far. So I'm also hopeful that there won't be any issues here.
Now, the Trinity Lutheran case comes out, probably the most important free exercise case. It could actually lead to the striking down of every Blaine Amendment or mini Blaine Amendment in America, which were all based in anti-Catholicism. Gorsuch will participate in that if the judge is confirmed by April the 19th. Therefore, I expect on most of the interesting questions, he's going to have to say, Senator, in keeping with longstanding tradition, I will have to decline to comment on your question as it might be interpreted by a party to the case as my having taken a position in advance of argument. Do you expect to hear that a lot this week?
I do, and I think that some on the left, some on the progressive left, are going to spin that as, oh, you know, this is controversial. He's unwilling to tell us what he's going to do. But in fact, that is proper protocol, and I would be hopeful at least that that's what he would say if he was put in a situation where he had to answer a question about a potentially pending matter.
So let's turn then to the repeal and replacement of Obamacare, because here we had some news in the last hour. Jim Renacci, congressman from Ohio, a member of Ways and Means and a member of Budget, said that he's been informed there are a number of major amendments going to be made in the manager's amendments, including increased credits for seniors, including changes to the Medicaid rules about states being allowed to participate or not participate, and many other changes. Lonnie, you know, the Democrats got in trouble by springing changes here. Do you think that that charge will lay against Speaker Ryan if the manager's amendment appears, makes significant changes, and is voted on quickly?
Well, I don't think so, Hugh, because the issues relating to the American Health Care Act, the issues relating to the Republican Obamacare replacement are well known. You know, I've always maintained that I think this is a good platform. It's a good start. But the notion, for example, of doing something about the Medicaid expansion, potentially to help those states that have taken the expansion and are concerned about what this might do, or helping potentially to accelerate the timeline on Medicaid expansion to placate some who are worried about the timing, or beefing up the credits to help those who are older and potentially sicker. I think these are known issues, and so the idea of trying to address them through a manager's amendment, you know, people have known this is a possibility for a while. So I don't think so, unless they go in a drastically different direction, which I don't think they'll do. My sense is that this will be something that will be looked upon favorably by many.
Now, I want to play for you Secretary Price yesterday. I want to go over a couple of things he said to George Stephanopoulos and get your reaction, Lonnie Chen, because you are an Obamacare specialist. Let's play cut number 15.
I do, as a matter of fact, because what the CDO looked at and what they were charged with looking at is just one portion of the plan. Now, the overall plan is not just this piece of legislation before Congress right now, which I think is an integral part, an important step in all of this, but it's the second phase of all of this, which is ongoing as we speak, but it includes all of the administrative changes that need to be put in place, and then a third phase, which also is ongoing as we speak, which are multiple other pieces of legislation that round out the plan and make it so that it fulfills the president's promise of repealing and replacing Obamacare and putting in place a patient-centered system where we get patients and families and doctors making medical decisions and not Washington,
D.C. He was standing by his claim that no one will be hurt by this bill. I actually don't think it's possible to calculate winners and losers at this point, Lonnie. What do you think?
Yeah, I tend to agree that at this point it is very difficult to tell. I think some of the conclusions that are being reached by people in the media are a little bit facile. It's not clear to me that we know exactly what's going to happen and who's going to be affected. I think we can theorize about that. And I think the point he's trying to make, Secretary Price is trying to make, is look, the second phase of this, which is administrative, is going to be very important. And what happens in terms of what the administration does to give greater flexibility to states, for example, to do things on Medicaid, the flexibility that they might give states who want to formulate their own health care reforms, I think that is crucially important. And that is going to be very difficult for CBO, for example, to account for. The estimates that they put out last week did not. All they can do is look at the face of the legislation and say, hey, what do we think is going to happen? But I don't, in fact, think we have great visibility into exactly who will be harmed, if you will, who will be hurt. I think we have a sense, and that's why the manager's amendment is important to help address those issues.
Coming up,
Americans have been reporting declining happiness for a decade.
The World Happiness Report, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Be happy, be happy now. Woo.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It seems we humans never tire of the pursuit of happiness, or at least thinking and talking about it. My friend and colleague Dennis Prager devotes a full hour to happiness every Friday on his show. The Bible addresses happiness. Counselors do what they can to improve your happiness. And yet for many, happiness is very elusive. If that's not enough, the World Happiness Report, which gauges the happiness in countries around the world, says America's happiness level is in decline. Here's Michael Medved.
The headline in the Washington Post says the World Happiness Report is out and the U.S. has fallen. Sad. What is this based on, and what is the happiest place on earth? What is the least happy place on earth? The 22 nations, or 21 of the 22 nations, at the very bottom of this list, and they rank 155 nations. Look, this is an interesting process, and not to give away the entire game, but the headline in USA Today, it says, the Norse, of course, are the happiest people on earth. Robust economy, trust are keys. U.S. declines to 14th. Okay, still not bad, but here's the way that they define happiness in this study. Is they define it based upon a number of metrics. They say people are asked to envision a ladder, according to this survey, where their best possible life would being a 10 on the top rung and the worst possible life being a 0. And then they ask people, where does your life fall on that ladder? Six key variables are then used to explain these overall happiness scores, according to the report. Income, number one. Healthy life expectancy. Having someone to count on in times of trouble. Generosity. Freedom and trust. And the latter are measured by the absence of corruption in business and government. Could that be one of the reasons the United States fell to 14th? It's too bad, the United States being 14th. So what's number one? Number one is Norway. And by a lot, and the numbers are kind of amazing, because remember, number 10 means that people in general are saying that's the happiest life I could possibly lead. I'm living it. In Norway, the overall ranking is 7.537. Denmark, which won last year, is second. Iceland is third. Switzerland is fourth. Do we detect a pattern here? Finland is fifth. Netherlands, sixth. Seventh? Oh, Canada. Eighth, New Zealand. Ninth, Australia. And tenth, Sweden. Okay, we're talking about small countries by population. I know Canada's borderline not small anymore, but it's still, I mean, considering the huge amount of land area that Canada occupies and a population of about 30 million, it's one-tenth the population of the United States, less than, with actually more territory, more land, and not all of it so comfortable, and even in late March. What's the problem for the U.S.? The way that they cover it, and the way that they report on this entire thing, it says Americans, on the other hand, have been reporting declining happiness for a decade. So you can't blame President Trump. While the United States has improved in two of the six variables used to calculate happiness, higher income per capita and healthy life expectancy, the United States has suffered when it comes to the four social variables. American citizens are now reporting less social support, less sense of personal freedom, lower donations, and more perceived corruption of government and business. There's a very, very interesting couple of pieces by two outstanding conservative writers, both of whom are friends of mine, one a good friend of mine. But Arthur Brooks writes in the New York Times a profoundly important piece. He said, depressed by politics, just let go. And he's not saying don't get involved with politics. What he's saying is take control, because what depresses people about politics, and he goes through the psychological evidence, and I think this goes to part of why America has fallen in terms of the happiness index. He takes a look at the General Social Survey, which is collected every year by the National Opinion Research Center at University of Chicago. Everyone uses it. The results are significant, he says. Even after controlling for income, education, age, gender, race, marital status, and political views, people who are very interested in politics drive up the likelihood of your reporting being not too happy about life by about 8 percentage points. In other words, being very interested in politics makes you unhappy? And no, because causation and correlation are different things. It could be that the people who are most unhappy are most interested in politics. You're looking for some way to fix your situation. But he says behavioral science shows that the link might just be causal through what psychologists call external locus of control. That refers to a belief that external forces, such as politics, have a large impact on your life. An external locus of control brings unhappiness. Three social psychologists showed this in a famous 2004 paper published in the journal Personality and Social Psychology Review. Studying surveys of students over several decades and controlling for life circumstances and demographics, they compared people who associated their destinies with luck and outside forces with those who believed they were more in control of their own lives. They conclude that an external locus is correlated with worse academic achievement, more stress, and higher rates of depression. Now, this is very important because it also suggests that people who hold more conservative views would be happier because you depend less on government as the source of your happiness. You don't have that external locus of control. And guess what? There are tons of other studies that show, everything else being equal, holding somewhat conservative views also contribute to happiness.
Coming up,
young Americans in the millions have been taught and are being taught to be unhappy.
In the final segment of the Town Hall Review, stay with us. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It would seem obvious that today's standard of living, the highest in world history in terms of material wealth, would lead to widespread happiness. Why then should this not be the case for young folks on our college campuses? Here's Dennis Prager.
I have a perfect example for you. The University of Arizona has issued a booklet to all students, teaching them that if they are in any way offended by anything they hear from another student, from a teacher, in just normal social intercourse, and if they feel offended, they're supposed to say, ouch. And the other person is then supposed to respond, oops. Now, my dear friends, I charge our universities with making unhappier people. Incidentally, according to report after report that I read, more young Americans are depressed than equivalent at any other time in history. They have been taught to be depressed. You go to college and you are taught there are two types of Americans, the persecuted and the persecutors. So you are either a persecutor, which is depressing, or you are persecuted, which is depressing. Correct? Is that not fair? Telling people how offended they are. There's a man, he's truly, I believe he is a hysteric. I think he's bona fide hysteric, who writes at the New York Times editorial page. He happens to be black, and that's relevant to this. He has written on a number of occasions how he tells his children how racist America is. Now, let me ask you a question. If your father constantly told you that the society loathes you, would you be a happier person or a less happy person? That is what we call not difficult to answer. This man, I believe, engages in a form of child abuse with his children, telling them that America hates them. I was never told that. My father, may he rest in peace, wrote his college thesis on anti-Semitism in the United States and raised me to believe this was the best country a Jew could ever live in. How do you like that? He somehow could juggle the two facts. Yes, there was anti-Semitism. Yes, there were anti-Semites. And it's the best place a Jew could live.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review. Tell a friend, sign up for a podcast of our program at townhallreview.com. And be sure to follow us now on Twitter at Town Hall Review. That's at Town Hall Review. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richard, Derek Fowler, and Dwayne Patterson, I'm Hugh Hewitt. Join us again next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the weekend review program from a perspective you can trust.